Hello, everyone. Welcome to Business Trip, a podcast about the future of mental health and the startups building it. I'm Matija Serebrinski, and I'm a partner at Sime Adventures, a fund investing in mental health. In early 2024, I hosted a panel at The Battery. The Battery is a private club in San Francisco that's very well known among the tech Illuminati. The panel was called Chemical Conversations, Comparing Psychedelic Compounds. It was a full house, and I brought my microphone to record the conversation and share it with our listeners at home. Joining me on stage were Nolan Williams, Alison Feduccia, and Matt Baggett. Nolan is a professor at Stanford, currently researching ibogaine, among other areas in psychiatry and neurology. Alison is the founder of Psychedelic Support, a platform providing psychedelic education, community, and a provider directory. Matt Baggett is the co-founder and CEO of Tactogen, a company developing compounds that are inspired by MDMA and aim to improve MDMA's safety and efficacy profile. The conversation explores many topics. We spent some time talking about the basics of the pharmacology of psychedelics like MDMA, ibogaine, and psilocybin. We also get into some big unanswered questions, like what is the mechanism in psychedelics that induces behavioral change? Is therapy necessary? How will we address the impending shortage in therapists? At the end, we answered audience questions. I'm glad we allowed time for these questions. Some of them were really good. Let's jump into our panel. Maybe we start by three of you folks introducing yourselves.
Hey, so Nolan Williams, associate professor of psychiatry, radiology at Stanford University, and run a lab doing experimental therapeutics work, and had some recent work come out around ibogaine and its use in wounds of war. So I'll talk a little bit about that.
Raise your hands who knows what ibogaine is. It's pretty good, yeah.
Hey everyone, I'm Matt Baggett. I'm a neuroscientist and I'm CEO and co-founder of Tactogen, which is a public benefit corporation that's working to develop MDMA-like compounds that are gentler and will hopefully be more accessible to more people.
And disclaimer, the fund that I co-founded is an investor in Tactogen.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here tonight with you all. I'm Dr. Alison Feduccia. You can call me Allie. And I got involved with MDMA research back in 2004 and have worked on some clinical programs looking at MDMA-assisted therapy. And the last few years, I've been focusing on the education and community outreach programs that are looking to help folks know more about psychedelic medicines, as well as the research findings that are coming out from the studies that both of these gentlemen are doing. So thanks for having me.
Pleasure. And my name is Matthias. I'm co-founder of a venture fund called Sime Adventures. We invest in what we call frontier mental health. So psychedelic therapeutics is a part of that area of frontier mental health. I'm also the co-host of a podcast that's called Business Trip, where we kind of explore the intersection of psychedelics and the business world. Cool. Well, so maybe we start by each one of you sharing a little bit more about the psychedelic compounds that you researched in your career and share what's unique to them and why you focused on those ones.
Sure, I can start. MDMA, some of you may know this as ecstasy, but in the clinical context, the substance is furthest along in the FDA development pipeline for treating PTSD. And the way that it's being delivered is in combination with psychotherapy. So there's an extensive course where individuals will have preparation, they'll go through these medicine-assisted psychotherapy sessions, and then there's also an intensive integrative process where there's no medication on board, but they continue to have this unraveling of what the experience showed them. And what's been shown in the clinical research studies is that individuals with chronic severe PTSD have a significant response that's durable and can catalyze this therapeutic process in ways that other medications have not been shown to do. But when we think about psychedelics, they come in many different flavors. They have different pharmacological effects, different effects on how people feel. In contrast to MDMA, there's psilocybin, which some of you may have been here last year. We hosted a talk about a study we're conducting with a few different universities looking at psilocybin for palliative care or for folks that are at the end of their life, and how these experiences of touching the mystical or visionary states can help someone face anxiety or existential distress at the end of life, maybe find other parts of themselves that they can connect with their loved ones when they're nearing death. So that's just a little piece of what psychedelic therapies are being investigated right now. I'd say psilocybin and MDMA probably are furthest along, and some of the more investigational ones that are actually available in other countries right now, ibogaine in Mexico and ayahuasca and several other compounds as well as novel ones that we would like to share more about and understand what the next steps of the research are.
So in terms of the next steps of the research, one of the things to understand about MDMA and its class of compounds is that at their best, like the core therapeutic feeling is a feeling of self-acceptance and decreased avoidance and decreased neuroticism, where you can think about things that would normally really upset you and that you normally just kind of push out of your consciousness, and you can regard them in a more gentle, accepting, sympathetic way, and often make really dramatic therapeutic progress in understanding yourself, why you are the way you are, how you could be different, and how you could get there. And that kind of experience has, I think, potential to help a lot of people. So that's entactogens at their best. But for many people, when you have this experience, you're also feeling maybe your stomach's upset, or you're feeling kind of stoned or drunk or sedated. And for some people, your blood pressure goes up to kind of worrisome levels. And so what we've been trying to do at Tactogen, and it really builds on my scientific interest for decades before that, is figure out ways to dial down all of those unwanted side effects and really make medicines that could give people this gentler core experience. And if we can do this, we potentially might be able to have medicines that could be used outside of this kind of really intense preparation, lots of monitoring for safety, expensive contacts that MDMA is being used in today. So that's the vision, and that's what entactogens are like. And so as I've described entactogens, they are kind of psychedelics, but they're psychedelics in the sense of like the sort of colloquial use of the term. And really, psychedelic is, it's almost like anything that the hippies like to take. And there isn't necessarily a clear pharmacological thing that is in common between, like, say, a psilocybin and an MDMA and a ketamine. But as we're going along, we are starting to see that there might be some kind of fast-acting, afterglow-like, antidepressant-like effect that all these seem to have in common. And it's kind of a funny thing where you had the psychiatrists who were giving LSD and thought it was going to be something transformative for society, and then LSD was taken away from them as a tool, and a lot of them switched to ketamine. And so in the 1970s, there was a fair amount of ketamine psychotherapy being done. And then when MDMA came along, all the people that were doing the ketamine therapy switched to doing MDMA therapy. So there is this kind of continuity there, but there are also these big differences. And one of them is this gentleness that MDMA can have at its best, whereas a classical psychedelic like an LSD, or I think we'll hear about ibogaine in a second from Nolan, they often have experiences that are more challenging on average. And maybe I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, so I'm a physician, and observed that we haven't, in modern culture, modern medical culture, we haven't really prioritized meeting people at the level of acuity that they end up being in many circumstances, in the kind of worst cases where people end up in the hospital, suicidal and depressed. And so my group has really focused on developing rapid-acting treatments. Psychedelics are obviously part of that repertoire. We have a couple other things that we're working on that I'm happy to talk about later. But that's really the kind of central theme, is we need to have treatments that get people well in the kind of time frame that an emergency happens. It can't be that you bring somebody in the psych hospital and give them Prozac and have them leave and they're still not feeling any better. That just doesn't make any sense. So that's been our focus. You know, we very interested in ketamine mechanism, as you heard from some of the other panelists, and that's pretty far along in our understanding of that as an antidepressant. And we were interested in this idea that there's probably like a concert of mechanisms that produces what we're talking about as a psychedelic experience, that it is unlikely to be mediated through one receptor system. And that seems to be true for ketamine. We were able to show that in the presence of an opiate blocker blocking endogenous or kind of self-generated opioids, you can actually block the antidepressant effect of ketamine, right? And so this idea that not only do you need the glutamate effect, but you need the opioid, the kind of endogenous self-generated opioid effect to be able to be therapeutic. And so at least two neurotransmitter systems necessary for producing an antidepressant effect in ketamine. And with that finding, got really interested in this idea of ibogaine, which is about as broad, I would say, of a series of mechanisms of action, you know, that any of the psychedelic agents may have. Profoundly broad. It affects two different neurotrophic factor systems. It affects serotonin, it affects glutamate, it affects the opioid receptor systems. And there was this interesting phenomenon that was going on right around the time, you know, when we were thinking a lot about this kind of general idea, where Navy SEALs and special operators were going down to Mexico to take ibogaine for wounds of war. And so I talked to many of these gentlemen. They seemed totally normal to me in conversation. But if you hear the stories before they went down to Mexico, they were quite distraught, cognitively impaired, unable to really do activities of daily living, and then came back with this kind of miraculous improvement that was totally driven by a grassroots within kind of Navy SEAL teams kind of word of mouth phenomenon, which I thought a lot about this as a thing. You know, why is this going on? Like, how can this be happening? There are thousands of special operators and whatnot that have gone down to Mexico. And the last time that I could find in history that something like this has happened is scurvy, vitamin C deficiency, a couple hundred years ago, where people were taking fruit in droves and driving actually medical research. And so the first randomized trial in the history of medicine actually was driven from sailors making observations about eating fruit on long sea journeys, right? And Dr. James Lind constructed the world's first randomized trial based off of that. And so we took on this idea of trying to do a trial around essentially a phenomenon that was happening where SEALs were going down and having ibogaine for wounds of war. And so, as you can imagine, Stanford, when I approached them with this, was a little cautious about this idea. Lots of people told me no. And then I just kept asking in different ways, and then eventually found a way to get them to agree. We started this trial in 2021. About 9 months later, wrapped up the initial data collection at the like immediate post time point. And lo and behold, we had pretty profound changes across like a wide range of domains, you know, so PTSD, anxiety, depression, but then also disability related to traumatic brain injury. So more of a neurological change, which I thought was unique about this and quite striking, and probably related to some of the neurotrophic factor effects. And kept following folks, like kept extending the study. I think we extended the study like a bunch of times because everybody kept staying well. And so we kept extending the trial, which extended the budget and the complexity. But nonetheless, we got out to a year now of data where most people are holding it, which is just totally wild. And yeah, we've just been transformed by this data, you know, and my kind of viewpoints on what, how to think about these problems, you know, and what makes sense as therapeutics in those spaces and the patients and their stories. And so we're at a place now where we're trying to actually do this in the United States, which is challenging. This comes with a baggage of having an arrhythmia risk. We think we may have found a way to mitigate it by co-administering cardiac stabilization drugs to reduce the risk of the arrhythmia, but nonetheless, have some work to do there and hopefully get this through FDA so we can actually do a trial in the U.S. and start treating veterans in the United States, which would intuitively make sense, right? Thank you.
Cool. Very quickly explain what ibogaine is, and then maybe that's a good segue for sharing the same about MDMA and psilocybin for you folks as well.
Yeah, so ibogaine is derived from a Central West African root bark of a tree called the iboga tree, and so that root bark has a host of alkaloids. Ibogaine is one of many alkaloids and the one that's most explored and thus most utilized in countries where it's not considered a controlled substance. It produces this psychological phenomenon that I don't think we have neuroscience to explain, which is that folks end up having this experience of what they call a slideshow or a life review, where they actually go through and track through a bunch of emotionally salient earlier life memories in which they're able to see them, reprocess them, have a new perspective on them, and then seemingly put them, some of the traumatic ones, to rest. And it's likely that concert of neurotransmitters in the proportions and the way that it happens that produces this emergent phenomenon that I don't think any pharma company in the world could come up with that mechanism from scratch right now. We just have no sense of that. Allie probably agrees with me on that.
So I actually have a question. Back in the day, people were using ibogaine a lot for treating opioid dependence, and they probably still are.
Yep.
And one of the things that people observed was there was a seemingly long-lasting anti-craving effect, where it's almost like it reset your brain or something. The sort of scientific hand-waving at the time was that ibogaine would get metabolized into noribogaine, just a similar compound, and that would get stored in the fat and slowly come out and provide this kind of support. And in some ways, it seemed to me like that's science can't really accept the idea of the brain actually changing yet. And so this is what we're going to go with for now. But I noticed you didn't mention noribogaine. Is that still an idea that's out there, or is it kind of fallen by the wayside?
Yeah, I mean, I think people that have been instrumental in understanding noribogaine and looking at that are still looking at it. I think the emergent life review piece seems to be an ibogaine-driven phenomenon, and then it converts into the kind of the secondary phase once the noribogaine is predominant. And so from my perspective, and I guess we'll probably talk about this, the kind of trip matters. And so you skip that step, you may skip some of the therapeutic benefit of the ibogaine itself. But one of the mouse studies that was done that was published in PNAS 15, 20 years ago is this idea that I took mice to the bar or to the self-administration tube and gave them alcohol and got them alcohol addicted, and then gave them ibogaine and the mouse stopped drinking, which is what you would anticipate. And they took a second set of mice, then they did the same thing, and instead of giving them ibogaine, they drilled a small hole and injected glial-derived neurotrophic factor, that dopamine upregulating neurotrophic factor, into the ventral tegmental area, the area that's involved in dopamine neurons that reinforce reward, and they were able to produce an identical abstinence. And so it's my view that the GDNF effects, just like what you're saying, produces probably a profound effect on the brain that probably is pretty durable. And we have data out to a year with a single dose of ibogaine to suggest that this is way longer than the pharmacology could be sticking around. It's certainly not exuding out of the fat at a year, I'm sure, right? And so it's got to be that the brain, as you're pointing out, Matt, actually changes, which is, it's not something that everybody wants to accept because it's so hard to do, you know?
Maybe Matt or Ali, let's start with MDMA and then hypothesize about novel chemical entities or different entactogens. How is it different or similar how MDMA interacts with our bodies and our brains versus kind of what Nolan shared for ibogaine?
You know, when I think about MDMA, it acts in a really peculiar way in that it will bind to a transporter that normally takes serotonin back into the neurons. And it acts like a sly fox, and it opens up the gate, and it allows lots of serotonin to rush out, as well as dopamine and norepinephrine. And what it can do from that point is stimulate the release of oxytocin and other hormones. And this is important in contrast to psilocybin or LSD, which binds to a serotonin receptor and activates a response. Some of the side effects that Matt was describing are related to the mechanism of this release of serotonin. But with these neurochemicals and hormones, particularly oxytocin, which is known as the bonding hormone, or when a baby is born, it's released from the mother and the baby, or if you interact with a pet, you'll release oxytocin. And so in the context of therapy, our understanding of how MDMA-assisted therapy works is that a person is able to really go deep into this process of getting to know their traumatic memories, getting to know other elements of themselves that may have been blocked or they may have disassociated from, to protect themselves from emotional injury over time. And this long course of therapy in the setting with two trained therapists and this trust that can develop to really go deep into a process of bringing up these memories, and whether it's that the brain is able to refile, put new information onto these memory traces and put them back in the brain in a different order that's no longer triggering PTSD symptoms is one hypothesis about how it actually works. I think it has a lot to do as well with the longer periods of time that someone is under in this state of consciousness where they are able to grasp aspects of themselves that are typically hidden or under the surface or unavailable. And so this process of going deep into emotion and living that and feeling that has a very therapeutic effect for many individuals. And it's also why MDMA might be a really useful compound for other conditions as well, is if psychological entanglements or what are holding someone back, then this medicine can help to undergo a psychotherapeutic process, which is really different if we think of just like taking a medication every day and relying on that medication to change something about our neural pathways or our physiology. It's that it's resolving something there. And I think there's something beyond just the pharmacology. It's that, especially with psilocybin or LSD, it's common that people have a mystical or spiritual experience, which as a scientist, it's really hard to describe that and talk about data that supports how spirituality can improve someone's life or their outcomes. But my observation is that it brings more meaning and purpose, and it helps to take the mystical into the mundane of daily living and to see the miracle of what life is really all about. And so those glimpses of a broader reality or expanded state, I think can't be emphasized or underscored enough of the role that probably plays in these contexts. And then the therapy after or the support after that helps someone take those lessons or take what insights came and really think about, well, how can I shift this or that in my life to be living my most authentic and true expression of myself in this life. And so in that way, I think as scientists, we don't have a good way to really know exactly why it works or how it helps all these different conditions. So I remain curious and open to the mystery of what we don't know or what we can't quantify. So that's where I see MDMA really lands in this piece with therapy. And if we know that a lot of people have taken ecstasy over the years and it doesn't necessarily resolve their hang-ups in life or help them get over depression or PTSD per se. So I really see the value of this supportive context or therapy to go along with the medicines that are delivered.
There is actually a scale that quantifies mystical experiences. And there's at least one study that I'm aware of where the occurrence of mystical experiences was highly correlated with positive therapeutic outcomes. And this is a good kind of segue to Matt as well. But one of the things that we even thought and are working at SciMed is like there could be other compounds that are more effective at helping patients achieve or reach these mystical experiences. I don't think we know how to do that yet, but that's also interesting about kind of the present and the future of psychedelics, where it may feel like there's like these five or six compounds and that's it, but actually the potential is much larger than that.
I agree, and I think it's really clear that the mystical experience is something that people find deeply meaningful, and it often changes the story of their lives, and there's sort of the before and the after. But I don't think we really know yet whether and how much that experience really matters. As far as I can tell, my read on the literature is that the best predictor of these therapeutic outcomes really is dose. My take on it is that there's an inherent afterglow effect that these compounds share that gives you more openness towards the possibilities of life. And in that window of openness, you can achieve a lot of therapeutic progress. If at the beginning of this window you had some kind of experience that's, hey, your understanding of the world was inadequate, it's going to accelerate your ability to do things in this open window of plasticity. And this might also explain why if you just went out partying and then you go back after partying and you go back to your ordinary life and you're in this kind of hyperplastic state, it may be that you're not going to get a therapeutic benefit because you just went back into the ordinary crap of your life without really working on anything. And so you're kind of not giving it a chance to have inherent therapeutic effects. And so I think what we need to do scientifically is run the right experiments to really look at this carefully. Because of course we should give people medicines that help them to heal and have transformative experiences. But it's also the case that these experiences can be challenging and terrifying for long periods of time. And they're not necessarily right for everybody. Not everyone has just the space in their life to process the kind of weirdness that can happen in these psychedelic states. And so it would be nice if there were options for everyone to make these kinds of experiences, these abilities, these possibilities of changing your life accessible to everyone. So I think that's where science has to go.
I want to hear more of your opinions on this idea of all the psychedelics being used for everything. Or not?
Yeah. So we measured a lot of things in these veterans and saw kind of this very broad effect, which is, you know, suspect, right? Like, can't be that this is something that affects this broad of things, right? Why would that be? And what was really interesting is most of the participants drank coffee in the morning and had a caffeine habit, as many or maybe most of us do, right? And they all stopped drinking coffee, part of the placebo effect is what we call expectancy. So an on-target effect is, hey, you're going to get this drug for depression, and you get the drug for what you think is treating depression, and all of a sudden your depression's better, and you can't untangle that from the expectancy of expecting to be better. But when you have something that's unexpected, like you just stop after 20, 30 years drinking coffee just because you don't find it to be necessary anymore, it's an interesting observation, right? And so what the kind of holistic meta-observation for us was with Ibogaine was that Ibogaine seems to exchange habitual behavior for choice, right? And so what was habitual and repeated and wired in, and there's like a process that we understand within neuroscience that this happens, you know, the kind of ventral striatum, the kind of reward-based system turns something that's initially driven by reward into habit. So it actually moves backward into the brain into what we call dorsal striatum. And there, it's likely something along those lines where it just wipes out that set of essentially remembered habitual behaviors. And so people will say they encounter something that they normally do, they remember that they encounter it. It's not like it wipes their memory. They're like, I used to drink coffee every day. I wonder if I actually need this. Maybe I don't. Maybe I won't drink coffee today. And then the next day happens and they feel the same way and then they don't drink it. Then all of a sudden they're just not drinking coffee anymore. And it goes like that. If you really talk to the patients, they describe it like that. And I think that's probably at the meta level a lot of why what Matthias is saying, we see this compound seems to affect this condition and that condition in some people. It's probably because it's those conditions are at a fundamental level artificial, as we all intuit, right? That really what the problem is much more central to the brain processes that are driving that quote unquote diagnosis. And in this case, it's habit, right? It's this compound that seems to kind of wipe out habit and reintroduce choice and habitual behavior. And my view is it's likely the same for a lot of these compounds, that they have some core mechanistic effect that will drive a change in the way that we as humans, or probably other mammals, see a situation or see a behavior or whatever it is, and that introduces a new way of seeing it. And the person changes in many cases.
And so is that something, this breaking up habit, that you would think would be in common across psychedelics, or is it more just ibogaine?
I think it's certainly ibogaine. And that seems to be, for whatever reason, a very consistent theme there. I think it's because it's so mechanistically different, I think it's driving that probably from a at least slightly different place, I would say. I think something like MDMA or psilocybin or LSD makes sense that it would also change habits, but probably from a different lens, right? You hear when you talk to folks that have taken those substances, they achieve a new perspective. It's actually way less for the ibogaine patients that they're necessarily, the perspective is driving the change. It just seems to be that they come out of it and they encounter these things, which nobody was in their trip thinking about how much coffee they were drinking. I can guarantee you that. And yet they stopped drinking coffee, right? So it seems to be almost a core mechanistic effect, not necessarily an insight derived from the trip.
We actually have it's only an N of one, but we have a similar anecdote with one of the novel entactogens where someone took it for other purposes and found they suddenly didn't need to use nicotine, which had become a habit that they knew they should do something about and they were using too much, but they didn't have any intention to stop, but then they just stopped. So,
Again, it's an N of one, and you definitely didn't do a tissue biopsy. So, why could that be, or why one could hypothesize that happened, right? Is it, if it's not mechanistic, is it about re-signifying something, or there's very, I would say, common theory that a lot of these things are rooted in trauma, so it's working through a trauma. We don't know for sure, but I'm curious, either you or Ali, if you can share a little bit more, how you think it could work with MDMA versus ibogaine.
I think there could be a lot going on, and I also like to consider, too, people that take these substances that don't necessarily have a diagnosis and then still have some sort of positive gains in their life. And it seems that this window of neuroplasticity, it opens the door where you do have this pause to make better decisions or to shift patterns in ways that may be too challenging or not the motivation in everyday consciousness or without the aid of these substances. But why do they work for all these different conditions? One mechanism might be inflammation and neuroinflammation. It's being shown that certain psychedelic compounds can reduce that. I've gotten really interested in the women's health issues and how there's a lot of anecdotal reports about women microdosing, and they have relief from menstrual cramps. They can undergo menopause symptoms more easily. Those are less hot flashes. And there is this biological mechanism potentially of this interaction between estrogen and serotonin. So it does kind of add up in that way from a pharmacological perspective. So I feel that with mental health conditions, it may be that people have different symptoms and they are able to have these experiences that allow them to address these underlying hangups in their life or address certain things that haven't been resolved for them. So I'm not sure that it's any particular pharmacology that is working for across these conditions when we talk about anxiety, depression, PTSD, end of life, addiction. But then again, with ibogaine, it can block the opioid receptor. So that might explain why there's a reduction in craving, and that gives someone that extra leg up to stay sober for longer and to get into a recovery process that's longer term past the initial effects of the medication. So all that's to say, I don't think we really know why each substance might work, and everybody's brain is different. So what might work for somebody may not work for the next person.
There's an idea in psychiatry that you alluded to just now that many of the different psychiatric diagnoses are different maladaptive behaviors that people have learned to deal with their suffering or their problems. And so there isn't necessarily really a fundamental difference in how the brain works between some of these disorders. It's more just that you came up with a routine for trying to self-soothe yourself or avoid the things that upset you or whatever. And so if there are fewer real underlying problems here, then it would make a lot of sense that psychedelics would work for a lot of them. And certainly if you just, and we did this as an exercise pretty recently, at Tactogen we tried to just count what percent of the adult population would end up having one of the indications that people have proposed Tactogens might work for. So, you know, PTSD is a certain percent, I don't know, 3-point-something percent of the adult population at any given time. Alcohol use disorder is close to 14%. Anorexia or binge eating disorders, that's a certain percent. And you start to add this up and it gets to be real big numbers. Plausibly, something more than 1 in 4 people are the group that could be helped by Tactogens. And it's similar to SSRIs, where we've tried SSRIs for a lot of these different indications, and they sometimes seem like they help people a bit. And certainly I took citalopram for a while, and I found it helpful, but not transformative. And I think there might be something to this idea that we're not just people with a hammer who thinks that everything is a nail, that we might be starting to get at something that's more about how you help a brain that's stuck get unstuck.
So with this idea of different approaches, different ways of accessing psychedelics, the medical model just being one of them, I want to chat for a few minutes about the role of therapy. And what it's interesting is that, so Nolan, the studies that you run, they had some psychological support, but definitely, or my understanding is that wasn't happening during the psychedelic journey. And then Matt, you're working on new chemical entities that potentially could be delivered at home, or just let's call them compounds that instead of being in front of a therapist, you could take them at home. And Ali, obviously the experience with MDMA is almost the opposite of that, where it's like very, very intense psychological support during with two licensed practitioners. And that has also an impact on costs and a few other things. So one of those big questions, like, is the trip necessary? The other ones, is therapy necessary?
Sure, yeah. This is, of course, a empirical question that we can answer. But the question is, how much reliable therapeutic progress can people make if they have some kind of exercises, therapeutic journaling, yoga, something that helps them get have a scaffold for their experience? And my take on it is that a lot of people will benefit from psychotherapy and should have that in the mix. But I also think that it's probable that a lot of people won't need that. And I'd like to collect the data and find out, because certainly it's a lot of added expense. And one of the reasons I think this is from seeing people on MDMA, watching videos of MDMA sessions, I don't think a whole lot of psychotherapy actually happens in those sessions. People need emotional support, but the changes are happening inside themselves. And if you're properly prepared, I don't think that it's really necessary to have two therapists in the room during that experience. And I understand why FDA wants that. FDA wants that, first of all, because MAPS told them it was necessary for the therapeutic effect. And MAPS thought that essentially because MAPS was trying to answer this question of why don't people have therapeutic benefits if they just take it on their own. And I think if you think that about this open plasticity window, then that starts to explain it, because you really need to hold your intention for a long time if you're in this malleable state for days after use of a compound, or at least one of these traditional compounds. But I think that it's plausible that we don't know the full range of ways that we can support people through beneficial experiences. We shouldn't just assume that what Stan Grof did in the 1960s and 70s for LSD really is the best way to approach MDMA therapy. And so we can collect the data on this, but what we do know is that there's group therapy that's being done in Switzerland right now, and certainly Leo Zeff, who is the first MDMA therapist, would do group sessions. There's a lot of potential here for finding ways to help people that won't mean that they have to drive 2 hours someplace, go to some session that takes them 8 to 10 hours, and then they have to stay there overnight because they can't drive back because they took this medicine earlier in the day. And that kind of dedication of time and resources is great if you can do it, but not everyone can do it. And so how can we make these beneficial experiences available to everyone? And I think there are ways to do that. And it might be that it's not going to be the best approach for someone with complex PTSD. Maybe those people really do need therapists in the room. But if I have adjustment disorder, like I got fired from my job and I just haven't had it together enough to apply for a new one, and I'm just like, I'm at loose ends and I need to recenter, or if me and my partner haven't been connecting and we want to set aside some time to connect, I think those are the kinds of things that you could plausibly work through on your own. And I would love to collect those data and find out. And I think we can do that in a way that's efficient. There's a lot of work done now on clinical trials that are adaptive and efficient, where you could pair your medicine with different types of support and relatively quickly learn which ones work and retain those, and learn which ones don't work and drop those. And so that's the kind of thing that we'd like to do in the near future with our research.
I'll just mention, we have a website, Psychedelic Support, which we put up in 2018 as a directory of licensed health providers and community groups. We also offer a lot of free courses and education. And from running the site for a number of years, I do see the need for a safety net, in that there's a lot of people experimenting with psychedelics in settings that may induce side effects, or the dosing or the impurity of substances that they're taking, and that the need for trained clinicians to help people work through really challenging or difficult experiences that they may encounter is critical as we talk about how much support someone needs, because it's going to be variable. And it's also, I think, very context dependent. So having the preparation in a therapy office and a psychiatrist particularly ever see some of these cases, that might really be necessary. But like you're saying, if it's more easier substance and less severe issues someone's trying to resolve, then it may be a much more cost-effective approach, but still with some way to access extra support if that's needed.
Absolutely. And Ali's website is a great resource.
Thanks.
I've thought a lot about this, and I agree with a lot of what Ali said earlier about the indigenous practice and the use of this for centuries. You know, that if I can do a thought experiment with you, right? So we're entering into the world of self-driving cars. I have a 1-year-old and a almost 4-year-old, and they probably won't ever drive a car, right? They're never going to. They're going to have a car drive for them, right? And at some point, there's going to be a point where there's no human that's ever driven a car on the planet. And then what if something happens and all of a sudden all these people have to start driving again, right? Can you imagine that world? That would be a very complicated world, a lot of car accidents all happening at once, right? And I think that's where we are with psychedelics in many ways, right? These things were made illegal in all of the Western world. They were still used by indigenous practices, but for the West, I mean, other than small groups of people, weren't used broadly. And I think what we're seeing, and the problem that we're going to probably enter into over the next decade, is this problem of what it would look like if my kids were all trying to learn how to drive all at the same time. We're all going to be exposed to these substances. We were talking about the just sheer number of people where therapeutic psychedelics could be helpful for them. And so I think we're going to see a lot of folks getting better, but we're also going to see a lot of complexity from essentially reintroducing this at mass scale to cultures and societies. And I think that's going to be the trick. And how to do that in a way that works at scale is going to be hard. Matt's kind of hitting on that, right? Like, there aren't that many psychotherapists around for all the people that are going to want to do this. So how do you do it? And how do you do it in a way that's safe? You know, and in my view, and we were talking about this earlier, is that machine learning and artificial intelligence is probably going to have to get involved to make it work. And how that happens is unclear, but it's got to be something that happens at scale that's safe. And it prevents a lot of folks from having the equivalent of a car accident with their with their brain, right? With where they take a psychedelic in the wrong setting and then they have a problem. And I think that's going to be a regulatory and clinical challenge that nobody's really clear on how to solve it at scale.
Yeah, no offense to the psychiatrists on the stage, but just because you have credentials doesn't mean the experience is going to go well either. I see this more as an art form and a calling. It's a much different type of therapy even than normal talk therapy where you see someone for 50 minutes or 90 minutes. So expecting that all of our medical professionals are going to be well suited to this as a profession is, I think, also a little naive.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but we're going to need whatever it is at scale, whatever psychedelic psychotherapist at scale, and whether it's somebody with credentials or not, it's going to have to be a large enough number of people to be able to address the need, as Matt's saying. And I think that that's the problem. Right now, the numbers aren't there for the need. And how do you deal with that?
The fact that folks, when they're under psychedelic, they're very vulnerable. And so there's this ethics component that makes it even harder to scale the support, right? Because in one way or another, at least my perspective is that you need some sort of reputation system or credentialing or something where these folks are not being taken advantage of at scale.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the peer support model, this is in group therapy work. I think this is really right for a lot of development and meeting the needs of this longer term care that, especially for things like addiction recovery, we know that these can be very effective models. So looking at that as a way of keeping it going, maybe after a therapy visit or at home session, to have that longer accountability and longer term to sort of process what came up in the experiences. Otherwise, they just become like peak events and you just forget, like your skiing trip last year or whatever.
Well, the TLDR for me is that we're still so early, even though that humans have been working with these compounds for millennia. We're still so early, and there are all these questions that are still unanswered. And maybe it's a little frustrating for someone that's not involved in the field, but for all of us that are working on this, it's exciting because there's still a lot to do versus being a field where everything has been figured out. With that being said, I have a ton more questions, but maybe we open the floor for Q&A and whatever everyone is dying to ask.
I think the crowd may be really familiar with the quality of journey MDMA and psilocybin can give, but ibogaine is something that we're not selling it at clubs. And I wanted to know about the quality of the journey of ibogaine, because there's something besides arrhythmia I'm hearing that makes people averse to doing it.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, right? When they call ayahuasca the kind of loving mother, they call ibogaine the stern father, right? That's the analogy. And so it's interesting. It in a pretty neutral way, shows you a lot of things that you don't necessarily want to see. I don't think there's much ibogaine at Burning Man either, right? For this reason, it's quite a trip, right? It's very long, so it's much longer of an experience than any of the other psychedelics. Depending upon your liver enzyme status, it can be really long if you are a slow metabolizer of 2D6, this specific enzyme in your liver. And so people have this very long experience of having to see these typically traumatic memories, and the drug seems to drive you into that place. I don't think that you can as easily shift attention away from it. It keeps bringing you back to that slideshow. And so for a lot of folks, it's a very hard experience. For some, because they're having to see things that they've not fully addressed for a long time. For others, they're having to see things about themselves they hid from themselves, right? They didn't necessarily want to know in their conscious mind, and then they realized them, And so you've got Navy SEALs that are crying for 12 hours straight that may not have cried in their entire adult life, in some cases, right? And they're crying for the first time. And so I think that it's definitely a different experience for that reason. And I think it's probably the least potentially recreational substance that you can come across. you know, but with it comes profound healing. You know, I've had a few folks that have gone down to Mexico that I knew and wanted, were compelled to call me the next day after they took it. Like, I'm not sure. And then they call me again a couple of days later. I feel better, you know? And so I think there's a whole process that gets played out with how this drug works. And at some point after all of that, then they hit that moment that I was talking about earlier where choice is inserted where habitual behavior was before. And I think that's where it gets very interesting. It's not in the trip itself, but it's in the result of the drug experience in which they encounter things that they used to do. And then it's this curious, huh, why did I do that? I mean, we do all sorts of things we don't necessarily know why we did. And I think that part can be pleasant, but you got to ride through a lot of effectively pain to get there.
Talked about MDMA and with it being the first psychedelic, if you will, that gets approved by the FDA. Could you comment on what form that, you know, first of all, I guess the timing, if you could guess at that, and then what form that would take, if that would be similar to ketamine where you can actually mail order it and do your kind of Zoom integration, or what form that'll take?
So the package that's been presented to the FDA is MDMA-assisted therapy. And so there will be this requirement to have it within the context of therapeutic sessions in a clinician's office. From there, it's going to be a lot of details that won't be known until FDA comes back after reviewing all the data, which has been submitted. But I think they're projecting by the end of this year, August of 2024, the FDA should come back with some either more questions or potentially approve it. And so what's up in the air is what type of training, what type of professionals can deliver it, how long does someone have to stay in the office? And the thing is that the FDA hasn't typically regulated psychotherapy. They regulate medications. And so this is a whole new platform procedure that is being proposed. But we can look to Spravato, which is a type of ketamine that has been approved. And there are lots of regulations that were written for that particular medication. You have to be in the doctor's office for 2 hours. But then we see that generic ketamine being prescribed off-label. You can get it online very easily. And that seemed to skip all the regulatory hurdles that we're going to probably see initially for most psychedelic medications that get approved, if they get approved.
Just an observation, a licensed clinical social worker, only worked with systems impacted youth and families. And it's been alluded to about like the accessibility, but as a society, right, like people are not well, and that is really impacting our folks that can't pay for this stuff even more. And I just wanted to highlight that, right? Because that's like a huge issue in looking around this room, right? And then two really quick questions. Oh, thank you. Two quick questions. Ibogaine, is there a microdosing protocol? And then secondly, speaking for a friend, I'm actually really curious, but also have there been any studies that look into combining psychedelic use with neurofeedback, just in terms of the brain plasticity? So thank you.
Yeah, I totally agree with you about the accessibility issues, and I think very top of mind. I think we've got a huge cost for loss of productivity. I mean, I think that as a culture, we're getting to a place where we understand that these conditions ultimately impact our ability to be our best selves and to be most productive in our lives, and that's a huge cost too. And so I think the world's going to have to do a recalculation of that whole thing. So what's interesting about ibogaine is it was actually used in France from 1930 to 1966 in low doses. And so so the French bound the Bouiti and Gabon using this and brought it back to France, figured out how to synthesize it and isolate it, and then they actually started using it at orders of magnitude less than what we're talking about up here. And at 10 to 20 milligrams, they were able to see some improvements in mood and concentration. It was used as a stimulant of sorts. And then, as did everything, it went on France's controlled substance list, right, in 66. But a pretty long period of time to be used medicinally. And your next question, part of my life is doing these psychedelic experiments. Part is developing devices, and we have non-invasive neurostimulation devices to treat psychiatric emergencies as well. And one of the big questions is, can you combine devices, whether it be neurofeedback or direct brain stimulation, with psychedelics? Because the brain has this, as I think everybody alluded to, this kind of opening of this critical period and this increase in plasticity. And so what do you do in that time, right? And so psychotherapy clearly is something that we're all advocating maybe a thing that would be useful for that context. But what if there are other things too, right? What if turning down certain brain regions actually while the brain's more plastic would make sense? And there's some early explorations of this, and I think that's going to be an important topic, right? Because at the end of the day, if we can combine therapeutics and combine technologies together to produce really long-lasting effects that wire in to produce that ideal state that people are trying to achieve, that's also a cost-cutting measure, right? And so it's not just a repeated thing, but it's something that we could have that would persist.
Yeah, and just to add and provide more information, UT Austin has some studies around ketamine and TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. And there are even clinics all over the U.S. where they're offering this combo therapy off-label, right? It hasn't been validated, but some clinics are offering that as well.
I think it's also worth mentioning that individuals that may be in marginalized situations, that just treating with these, say, MDMA-assisted therapy for trauma, if someone is just put back into a situation where they're completely triggered by trauma again and again, exposed to it, we can't really expect that the outcomes will be the same as someone that has a more supportive environment. And so that's another huge topic of conversation of how can these substances help everyone and be available for healing to them.
All right, we have time for one more.
This is kind of a short question, so you might be able to get to another one after this, but this is something that interests me, and it's a field I intend to go into at some point in the future. So I see a lot of things about like psilocybin or LSD or MDMA or ketamine. Is there a reason that I never see anything about mescaline and its use in this context?
There is a company, Journey Colab, that is looking at mescaline for alcohol use disorders. It's very early on in the drug development process, but I think overall that's also a very long-acting substance, maybe 8 to 12 hours, and potentially that may be why others have shied away from it, as well as it's plant-based as well. Many different species of cacti, San Pedro and peyote, you can have natural sources of mescaline. So that's a tricky part for, I think, anyone developing medications if there's a plant alternative that could potentially compete. But then again, we are seeing synthetic psilocybin being developed and other natural-based products that are being synthesized.
Yeah, I think one of the big things is that it takes about 8 to 10 years for peyote to fully grow. And so there's been in the decrim movements that have come across the country, there's been a specific earmarking of not decriminalizing peyote for the purposes of avoiding essentially an onslaught of use of Native Americans' peyote supply by non-Native Americans. And so you can get it from San Pedro, but it's like eating a whole cactus or something, I think, to get enough to be active. And so people are not cactus eaters generally, you know, and so I think that... So I think that's part of the trick. It's just one of these things where I think there's actually an active desire to protect that for the Native Americans and to not disrupt that. And so I think Journey Colab and others are trying to find ways to get around having to have a plant-based extract. It's a similar problem with ibogaine, too. You're going to need a non-plant-based source eventually.
But ibogaine is very tricky to synthesize, right?
You're absolutely right. Yeah, there's two chiral centers for potential stereoenantiomers. But it looks like you can teach yeast to do it.
Hmm. Clever yeast.
Yeah.
And San Pedro grow really well in California. Many of you probably have them in your garden and don't even realize that it's harboring this special little compound, mescaline.
there's photos of Home Depot selling San Pedro and stuff like that. So. Cool. Well, I think we need to wrap up. I'm going to stay for a few more minutes and invite you guys to do the same. So just last question, where can people find you? Let's start with you, Ali.
You can find me at Psychedelic Support and on LinkedIn. My name's Allison Fiducia. And thanks so much for coming today and all your curious minds.
I'm Matt Baggett, and you can write to me at matt@baggett.net or matt@tactogen.com, and I'm on LinkedIn as well. And get in touch.
Nolan Williams, so also on, I guess everybody's on LinkedIn. Also on LinkedIn is Nolan Williams, and then you can email me at stanford@nolanw@stanford.edu, so nolanw@stanford.edu. Happy to hear from you. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
This is Business Trip. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SciMed Ventures. And if you're building a company in frontier mental health, hit us up at hi@scimed.ventures, which you can find in the show notes. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Our editor is Jonathan Davis, with production led by Caitlin Nair. Sound design and engineering came from Nico Ray. Our theme music is by Dorian Love, and additional credits are in the show notes. This is Business Trip. Thanks for tripping with us. We'll see you next time.